The fight was over before it had begun, Drizzt realized. They had killed a couple of elite guards and nothing more. They had walked headlong into the pinnacle of Menzo Baranzon's power, the most high priestesses of the Spider Queen, and they had lost. Waves of guilt washed over Drizzt, but he dismissed them, refused to accept them. He had come out, and his friends had come beside him, because this had been Mithril Hall's only chance. Even if Drizzt had known that Matron Bayenri herself was leading this march, he would have come out here and would not have denied Brunner, Regis, and Catti Bree the opportunity to accompany him. They had lost, but Drizzt meant to make their enemy hurt. "Fight on, demon spawn," he snarled at the Glabrezu, and he fell into a crouch, waving his blades, eager to give his scimitar the meal it so greatly desired. The Tanari straightened and held out a curious metal coffer. Drizzt didn't wait for an explanation, and almost unintentionally destroyed the only chance he and his friends had. For as the Tanari moved to open the coffer, Drizzt, with the enchanted ankle bracers speeding his rush, yelled and charged right past the lowered pincers, thrusting his scimitar into the fiend's belly. He felt the surge of power as the scimitar fed. Catti Bree was too confused to strike, too overwhelmed to even cry out in protest as Mephil came right up to her and the wretched tentacles licked her face. Then, through the confusion, a single voice, the voice of Kazidea, her sword, called out in her head, "Strike!" She did, and though her aim was not perfect, Kazidea's wicked edge hit Mephil on the shoulder, nearly severing the Illithid's arm. Out of her daze, Catti Bree swept the tentacles from her face with her free hand. Another psionic wave blasted her, crippling her once more, stealing her strength and buckling her legs. Before she went down, she saw the Illithid jerk weirdly, then fell away and saw Regis staggering, his hair still dancing wildly. The halfling's mace was covered in blood, and he fell sidelong over the stumbling Mephil. That would have been the end of the Illithid, especially when Catti Bree regained her senses enough to join in, except that Mephil had anticipated such a disaster and had stored enough psionic energy to get out of the fight. Regis lifted his mace for another strike, but he felt himself sinking as the Illithid dissipated beneath him. The halfling cried out in confusion, in terror, and swung anyway, but his mace clanged loudly as it hit only the empty stone floor beneath him. It all happened in a mere instant, a flicker of time in which poor Brunner had not gained an inch toward his taunting foes. The Glabrezu, in pain greater than anything it had ever known, could have killed Drizzt then. Every instinct within the wicked creature urged it to snap this impertinent drow in half. Every instinct except one, the fear of Ertu's reprisal once the Tanari got back to the abyss. And with that vile scimitar chewing away at its belly, the Tanari knew it would soon make that trip. It wanted so much to snap Drizzt in half, but the fiend had been sent here for a different reason, and evil Ertu would accept no explanations for failure. Growling at the renegade Dewerden, taking pleasure only in the knowledge that Ertu would soon return to punish this one personally, the Glabrezu reached across and tore open the shielding coffer, producing the shining black sapphire. The hunger disappeared from Drizzt's scimitar. Suddenly, the ranger's feet weren't moving so quickly. Across the realms, the most poignant reminder of the time of troubles were the areas known as dead zones, wherein all magic ceased to exist. This sapphire contained within it the negative energy of such a zone, possessed the anti-magic to steal magical energy, and not Drizzt's scimitars or his bracers, not Kazidea or the magic of the drow priestesses could overcome that negative force. It happened for only an instant, for a consequence of revealing that sapphire was the release of the summoned Tanari from the material plane, and the departing Glabrezu took with it the sapphire. For only an instant, the fires stopped in the tunnel behind Catti Bree. For only an instant, the shackles binding Gandalug lost their enchantment. For only an instant, the block of goo surrounding Brunner was no more. For only an instant, but that was long enough for Gandalug, teeming with centuries of rage, to tear his suddenly feeble shackles apart, and for Brunner to surge ahead so that when the block of goo reappeared, he was beyond its influence, charging hard and screaming with all his strength. Matron Bayenry had fallen unceremoniously to the floor, and her drift disc reappeared when magic returned, hovering above her head. Gandalug launched a backhand punch to the left, smacking Quenthal in the face and knocking her back against the wall. Then he jumped to the right and caught Bladen Kirst's five-headed snake whip in his hand, taking more than one numbing bite. The old dwarf ignored the pain and pressed on, barreling over the surprised Bayenry daughter. He reached around her other shoulder and caught the handle of her whip in his free hand, then pulled the thing tightly against her neck, strangling her with her own wicked weapon. They fell in a clinch. In all the realms there was no creature more protected by magic than Matron Bayenry, no creature shielded from blows more effectively, not even a thick-scaled ancient dragon. But most of those wards were gone now, taken from her in the moment of anti-magic. And in all the realms there was no creature more consumed by rage than Brunner Battlehammer, enraged at the sight of the old, tormented dwarf he knew he should recognize, enraged at the realization that his friends, that his dear daughter, were dead or soon would be, enraged at the withered drow priestess, in his mind the personification of the evil that had taken his boy. He chopped his axe straight overhead, the many-notched blade driving down, shattering the blue light of the drift disc, blowing the enchantment into nothingness. Brunner felt the burn as the blade hit one of the few remaining magical shields, energy instantly coursing up the weapon's head and handle into the furious king. The axe went from green to orange to blue as it tore through magical defense after magical defense, rage pitted against powerful Dwyamers. Brunner felt agony, but would admit none. The axe drove through the feeble arm that Bayenry lifted to block, through Bayenry's skull, through her jawbone and neck, and deep into her frail chest. Quenthal shook off Gandalug's heavy blow and instinctively moved for her sister. Then, suddenly, her mother was dead, and the priestess rushed back toward the wall instead, through the green-edged portal, back into the corridor beyond. She dropped some silvery dust as she passed through, enchanted dust that would dispel the portal and make the wall smooth and solid once again. The stone spiraled in, fast transforming back into a solid barrier. Only Drisdo Erden, moving with the speed of the enchanted anklets, got through that opening before it snapped shut. Jarlaxle and his lieutenants were not far away. They knew that a group of wild dwarves and a wolfman had met Bayenry's other elite guards in the tunnels across the way, and that the dwarves and their ally had overwhelmed the dark elves and were fast bearing down on the chamber. From a high vantage point, looking out from a cubby on the tunnel behind that chamber, Jarlaxle knew the approaching band of furious dwarves had already missed the action. Quenthal's appearance, and Drizzt right behind her, told the watching mercenary leader the conquest of Mithril Hall had come to an abrupt end. The lieutenant at Jarlaxle's side lifted a hand crossbow toward Drizzt and seemed to have a perfect opportunity, for Drizzt's focus was solely on the fleeing Bayenry daughter. The ranger would never know what hit him. Jarlaxle grabbed the lieutenant's wrist and forced the arm down. Jarlaxle motioned to the tunnels behind, and he and his somewhat confused but ultimately loyal band slipped silently away. As they departed, Jarlaxle heard Quenthal's dying scream, a cry of sacrilege. She was yelling out a denial, of course, in Drisdo Erden's, her killer's face. But Jarlaxle realized she could just as easily, and just as accurately, have been referring to him. So be it. The dawn was bright but cold, and it grew colder still as Stumpet and Terrian Ducard, of the Knights in Silver, made their way up the difficult side of Keeper's Dale, climbing hand over hand along the almost vertical wall. "You're certain?" Stumpet asked Terrian. A half-elf, with lustrous brown hair and features too fair to be dimmed by even the tragedy of the last night. The knight didn't bother to reply, other than with a quick nod, for Stumpet had asked the question more than a dozen times in the last 20 minutes. "This is the right wall?" Stumpet asked. yet another of her redundant questions. Tarion nodded. Close, he assured the dwarf. Stumpet came up on a small ledge and slid over, putting her back against the wall, her feet hanging over the 200-foot drop to the valley floor. She felt she should be down there in the valley, helping tend to the many, many wounded. But if what the knight had told her was true, if Lady Illustrial of Silvery Moon had fallen up here, then this trip might be the most important task Stumpet Rakingclaw ever completed in her life. She heard Tarion struggling below her and bent over, reaching down to hook the half-elf under the shoulder. Stumpet's powerful muscles corded, and she easily hoisted the slender knight over the ledge, guiding him into position behind her against the wall. Both the half-elf and the dwarf breathed heavily, puffs of steam filling the air before them.
"We held the Dale,"
Stumpet said cheerily, trying to coax the agonized expression from the half-elf's face. "Would the victory have been worth it if you had watched Brunner Battlehammer die?" The half-elf replied, his teeth chattering a bit from the frigid air.
"You're not for knowing that Elastriel died,"
Stumpet shot back, and she pulled the pack from her back, fumbling around inside. She had wanted to wait a while before doing this, hopefully to get closer to the spot where Elastriel's chariot had reportedly gone down. She took out a small bowl shaped of silvery mithril and pulled a bulging water skin over her head.
"It is probably frozen,"
the dejected half-elf remarked, indicating the skin. Stumpet snorted. Dwarven holy water didn't freeze, at least not the kind Stumpet had brewed, dropping in a little 90-proof to sweeten the mix. She popped the cork from the water skin and began a rhythmic chant as she poured the golden liquid into the mithril bowl. She was lucky. She knew that, for though the image her spells brought forth was fuzzy and brief, an area some distance away, she knew this region, and knew where to find the indicated ledge. They started off immediately at a furious and reckless pace, Stumpet not even bothering to collect her bowl and skin. The half-elf slipped more than once, only to be caught by the wrist by Stumpet's strong grasp. And more than once Stumpet found herself falling, and only the quick hands of Tarion Ducard, deftly planting pitons to secure the rope between them, saved her. Finally, they got to the ledge and found Illustria lying still and cold. The only indication that her magical chariot had ever been there was a scorch mark where the thing had crashed, on the floor of the ledge and against the mountain wall. Not even debris remained, for the chariot had been wholly a creation of magic. The half-elf rushed to his fallen leader and gently cradled Illustrial's head in one arm. Stumpet whipped out a small mirror from her belt pouch and stuck it in front of the lady's mouth.
"She's alive,"
the dwarf announced, tossing her pack to Tarion. The words seemed to ignite the half-elf. He gently laid Illustrial's head to the ledge, then fumbled in the pack, tearing out several thick blankets, and wrapped his lady warmly, then began briskly rubbing Illustrial's bare, cold hands. All the while, Stumpet called upon her gods for spells of healing and warmth, and gave every ounce of her own energy to this wondrous leader of Silvery Moon. 5 minutes later, Lady Illustrial opened her beautiful eyes. She took a deep breath and shuddered, then whispered something neither Stumpet nor the knight could hear. So the half-elf leaned closer, put his ear right up to her mouth.
"Did we hold?"
Tarion Ducard straightened and smiled widely.
"Keeper's Dale is ours," he announced,
and Illustrial's eyes sparkled. Then she slept peacefully, confident that this furiously working dwarven priestess would keep her warm and well, and she was confident that, whatever her own fate, the greater good had been served, for the good of all goodly folk. Epilogue. Bergignon Béhenry was not surprised to find Jarl Axel and the soldiers of Bregan de Earth waiting for him far below the surface, far from Mithril Hall. As soon as he had heard reports of desertion, Bergignon realized that the pragmatic mercenary was probably among those ranks of drow fleeing the war. Methil had informed Jarl Axel of Bergignon's approach, and the mercenary leader was indeed surprised to find that Bergignon, the son of Matron Béhenry, the weapons master of the First House, had also run off in desertion. The mercenary had figured that Brigignon would fight his way into Mithril Hall and die as his mother had died. Stupidly.
"The war is lost," Brigignon remarked.
Unsure of himself, he looked to Methil, for he hadn't anticipated that the Illithid would be out here, away from the matriarch. The Illithid's obvious wounds, one arm hanging limply, and a large hole on the side of his octopus head, grotesque brain matter oozing out, caught Brigignon off guard as well, for he never expected that anyone could catch up to Methil and harm him so.
"Your mother is dead," Jarlaxle replied bluntly,
drawing the young Bayenri's attention from the wounded Illithid.
"As are your two sisters and Aurepol Dear."
Brigignon nodded, seeming hardly surprised. Jarlaxle wondered whether he should mention that Matron Bayenri was the one who had murdered the latter. He held the thought in check, figuring he might be able to use that little bit of information against Brigignon at a later time.
"Matron Xerath Cusor Lauren led the retreat from Mithril Hall's lower door,"
the mercenary went on,
"and my own force caught up to those drow who tried and failed to get in the eastern door,"
Brigignon added.
"And you punished them?"
Jarlaxle wanted to know, for he was still unsure of Brigignon's feelings about all of this, still unsure if he and his band were about to fight yet another battle down here in the tunnels. Brigignon scoffed at the notion of punishment, and Jarlaxle breathed a little easier. Together they marched on, back for the dark and more comfortable ways of Menzo Baranzon. They linked with Xerath and her force soon after, and many other groups of dark elves and humanoids fell into line as the days wore on. In all, more than 2,000 drow, a fourth of them Bayenri soldiers, had died in the assault on Mithril Hall, and twice that number of humanoid slaves had been killed, most outside the mountain, on Fourth Peak's southern slopes and in Keeper's Dale. And a like number of humanoids had run off after the battles, fleeing to the surface or down other corridors, taking their chances in the unknown world above or in the wild Underdark, rather than return to the tortured life as a slave of the drow. Things had not gone as Matron Bayenri had planned. Brigignon fell into line as the quiet force moved away, letting Xerath control the procession.
"Menzo Baranzon will be many years in healing from the folly of Matron Bayenri,"
Jarlaxle remarked to Brigignon later that day, when he came upon the young weapons master alone in a side chamber, as the army camped in a region of broken caves and short connecting tunnels. Brigignon didn't disagree with the statement and showed no anger at all. He understood the truth of Jarlaxle's words, and knew that much trouble would befall House Bayenri in the days ahead. Matron Xerath was outraged, and Mesbaris Armgo and all the other matron mothers would be too when they learned of the disaster.
"The offer remains," Jarlaxle said, and he left the chamber, left Brigignon alone with his thoughts.
House Bayenri would likely survive, Brigignon believed. Triel would assume its rulership, and though they had lost 500 skilled soldiers, nearly 2,000 remained, including more than 300 of the famed Lizard Riders. Matron Bayenri had built a huge network of allies outside the house as well, and even this disaster, and the death of Bayenri, would not likely topple the first house. There would indeed be trouble, though. Matron Bayenri was the solidifying force. What might House Bayenri expect from troublesome Gromf with her gone? And what of Triel, Brigignon wondered. Where would he fit into his sister's designs? Now she would be free to raise children of her own and bring them into power. The first son born to her would either be groomed as the house wizard or as a candidate for Brigignon's position as weapons master. How long, then, did Brigignon have? 50 years? 100? Not long in the lifespan of a dark elf. Brigignon looked to the archway, to the back of the departing mercenary, and considered carefully Jarlaxle's offer for him to join Bregan de Earth. Mithril Hall was a place of mixed emotions. Tears for the dead and cheers for the victory. All mourned Besnel and Ferbel, Regveld Harpel, and so many others who had died valiantly. and all cheered for King Brunner and his mighty friends, for Berthgar the Bold, for Lady Illustrial, still nursing her grievous wounds, and for Stumpet Rakingclaw, hero of both the Undercity and Keeper's Dale. And all cheered most of all for Gandalug Battlehammer, the patron of Clan Battlehammer, returned from the grave, it seemed. How strange it was for Brunner to face his own ancestor, to see the first bust in the Hall of Kings come to life. The two dwarves sat side by side in the throne room on the upper levels of the dwarven complex, flanked by Illustrial, with Stumpet kneeling beside the Lady of Silvery Moon's chair, nagging her to rest, on the right, and Berthgar on the left. The celebration was general throughout the dwarven complex, from the Undercity to the throne room, a time of gathering and of parting, a time when Belwar Dizengulp and Brunner Battlehammer finally met. Through the magic of Illustrial, an enchantment that sorted out the language problems, the two were able to forge an alliance between Blingdenstone and Mithril Hall that would live for centuries, and they were able to swap tales of their common drow friend, particularly when Drizzt was wandering around just far enough away to realize they were talking about him.
"It's the damned cat that bothers me,"
Brunner huffed on one occasion, loud enough so that Drizzt would hear. The drow sauntered over, put a foot on the raised dais that held the thrones, and leaned forward on his knee, very close to Belwar.
"Guinevar humbles Brunner," Drizzt said in the drow tongue, a language Belwar somewhat understood, but which was not translated by a lustrial spell for Brunner. "She often uses the dwarf for bedding."
Brunner, knowing they were talking about him, but unable to understand a word, hooted in protest, and protested louder when Gandalug, who also knew a bit of the drow tongue, joined in the conversation and the mirth.
"But sure'n the cat's not for using me son's head for a pillar," the old dwarf howled. "Too hard it be. Too. By Moradin, I should have left with the damned dark elves," a defeated Brunner grumbled.
That notion sobered old Gandalug, took the cheer from his face in the blink of an eye. Such was the celebration in Mithril Hall, a time of strong emotions, both good and bad. Caddybri watched it all from the side, feeling removed and strangely out of place. Surely she was thrilled at the victory, intrigued by the Zwerfnebli, whom she had met once before, and even more intrigued that the patron of her father's clan had been miraculously returned to the dwarven complex he had founded. Along with those exciting feelings, though, the young woman felt a sense of completion. The drow threat to Mithril Hall was ended this time, and new and stronger alliances would be forged between Mithril Hall and all its neighbors, even Nesme. Brunner and Berthgar seemed old friends now. Brunner had even hinted on several occasions that he might be willing to let the barbarian wield Aegis Fang. Caddybri hoped that would not come to pass, and didn't think it would. Brunner had hinted at the generous offer, mostly because he knew it wouldn't really cost him anything, Caddybri suspected. After Berthgar's exploits in Keeper's Dale, his own weapon, Bonkenfuera, was well on its way as a legend among the warriors of Settlestone. No matter what Berthgar's exploits might be, Bonkenfuera would never rival Aegis Fang in Caddybri's mind. Though she was quiet and reflective, Caddybri was not grim, not maudlin. Like everyone else in Mithril Hall, she had lost some friends in the war. But like everyone else, she was battle-hardened, accepting the ways of the world and able to see the greater good that had come from the battle. She laughed when a group of Zwerfnebli practically pulled out what little hair they had, so frustrated were they in trying to teach a group of drunken dwarves how to hear vibrations in the stone. She laughed louder when Regis bopped into the throne room, pounds of food tucked under each arm, and already so stuffed that the buttons on his waistcoat were near bursting. And she laughed loudest of all when Bitterdew Harple raced past her, Thibbledorf Puent scrambling on his knees behind the wizard, begging Bitterdew to bite him. But there remained a reflective solitude behind that laughter, that nagging sense of completion that didn't sit well on the shoulders of a woman who had just begun to open her eyes to the wide world. In the smoky filth of the abyss,
the Baelor Eirtu held his breath as the shapely drow, the delicate disaster, approached his mushroom throne. Eirtu didn't know what to expect from Lolth. They both had witnessed the disaster. The Baelor watched as the drow came through the mist, the prisoner, the promised gift in tow. She was smiling, but on the face of the Lady of Chaos, one could never hope to guess what that meant. Eirtu sat tall and proud, confident he had done as instructed. If Lolth tried to blame him for the disaster, he would argue, he determined, though if she had somehow found out about the anti-magic stone he had sent along with the Glabrezu.
"You have brought my payment?"
the Baelor boomed, trying to sound imposing.
"Of course, Eirtu," the Spider Queen replied.
Eirtu cocked his tremendous horned head. There seemed no deception in either her tone or her movements as she pushed the prisoner toward the gigantic, seated Baelor.
"You seem pleased,"
Eirtu dared to remark. Lolth's smile nearly took in her ears, and Eirtu understood. She was pleased. The old wretch, the most wicked of the wicked, was glad of the outcome. Matron Beanri was gone, as was all order in Menzo Baranzon. The drow city would know its greatest chaos now, thrilling inter-house warfare and a veritable spider-web of intrigue, layer upon layer of lies and treachery through each of the ruling houses.
"You knew this would happen from the beginning,"
the Baelor accused. Lolth laughed aloud.
"I did not anticipate the outcome,"
she assured Eirtu.
"I did not know Eirtu would be so resourceful in protecting the one who might end his banishment."
The Baelor's eyes widened, and his great leathery wings folded close around him, a symbolic if ineffective movement of defense.
"Fear not, my fiendish ally," Lolth cooed. "I will give you a chance to redeem yourself in my eyes."
Eirtu growled low. What favor did the Spider Queen now want from him?
"I will be busy these next decades, I fear," Lolth went on, "in trying to end the confusion in Menzo Baranzon."
Eirtu scoffed.
"Never would you desire such a thing," he replied.
"I will be busy watching the confusion, then," Lolth was willing to admit.
Almost as an afterthought, she added,
"and watching what it is you must do for me."
Again came that demonic growl.
"When you are free, Eirtu," Lolth said evenly, "when you have Driz Do'Urden entangled in the tongues of your merciless whip, do kill him slowly, painfully, that I might hear his every cry."
The Spider Queen swept her arms up then and disappeared with a flurry of crackling black energy. Eirtu's lip curled up in an evil smile. He looked to the pitiful prisoner, the key to breaking the will and the heart of Driz Do'Urden. Sometimes, it seemed, the Spider Queen did not ask for much. It had been 2 10-days since the victory, and in Mithril Hall the celebration continued. Many had left, first the 2 remaining men from Nesme and the Long Riders, along with Harkel and Belladon Delray, though Puent finally convinced Bitterdew to stick around for a while. Then Elustriel and her remaining knights in silver, 75 warriors, began their journey back to Silvery Moon with their heads held high, the lady ready to meet the challenges of her political rivals head-on, confident that she had done right in coming to King Brunner's aid. The Zverfnebli were in no hurry to leave, though, enjoying the company of Clan Battlehammer, and the men of Settlestone vowed to stay until the last of Mithril Hall's mead was drained away. Far down the mountain from the dwarven complex, on a cold, windy plain, Catti Bree sat atop a fine roan, one of the horses that had belonged to a slain Silvery Moon knight. She sat quietly and confidently, but the sting in her heart as she looked up to Mithril Hall was no less acute. Her eyes scanned the trails to the rocky exit from the mountains, and she smiled, not surprised, in seeing a rider coming down.
"I knew he'd follow me down here,"
she said to Drizdt-O-Erden when the ranger approached.
"We all have our place," Drizzt replied.
"And mine's not now in Mithril Hall,"
Catti Bree said sternly.
"Ye'll not change me mind."
Drizzt paused for a long while, studying the determined young woman.
"You've talked with Brunner?"
he asked.
"Of course,"
Catti Bree retorted.
"Ye think I'd leave me father's house without his blessings?"
"Blessings he gave grudgingly, no doubt," Drizzt remarked. Catti Bree straightened in her saddle and locked her jaw firmly.
"Brunner's got much to do," she said. "And he's got Regis and yourself."
She paused and held that thought, noticing the heavy pack strapped behind Driz's saddle.
"And Gandalug and Berkthgar beside him," she finished. "They've not even figured which is to rule and which is to watch, though I'm thinking Gandalug's to let Brunner remain king."
"That would be the wiser course," Drizzt agreed. A long moment of silence passed between them. "Berkthgar talks of leaving," Drizzt said suddenly, "of returning to Icewind Dale and the ancient ways of his people." Catti Bree nodded. She had heard such rumors. Again came that uncomfortable silence. Catti Bree finally turned her eyes away from the drow, thinking he was judging her, thinking, in her moment of doubt, that she was being a terrible daughter to Brunner, terrible and selfish.
"Me father didn't try to stop me," she blurted with a tone of finality, "and yourself cannot."
"I never said I came out to try to stop you," Drizzt calmly replied. Catti Bree paused, not really surprised. When she had first told Brunner she was leaving, that she had to go out from Mithril Hall for a while and witness the wonders of the world, the crusty dwarf had bellowed so loudly that Catti Bree thought the stone walls would tumble in on both of them. They had met again 2 days later, when Brunner was not so full of dwarven holy water, and to Catti Bree's surprise and relief, her father was much more reasonable. He understood her heart, he had assured her, though his gruff voice cracked as he delivered the words, and he realized she had to follow it, had to go off and learn who she was and where she fit in the world. Catti Bree had bought the words uncharacteristically understanding and philosophical of Brunner, and now, facing Drizzt, she was certain of the source. Now she knew who Brunner had spoken to between their meetings.
"He sent ye,"
she accused Drizzt. "You were leaving and so was I," Drizzt replied casually.
"I just could not spend the rest of me days in the tunnels," Catti Bree said,
suddenly feeling as if she had to explain herself, revealing the guilt that had weighed heavily on her since her decision to leave home. She looked all around, her eyes scanning the distant horizon.
"There's just so much more for me. I'm knowing that in me heart. I've known it since Wulfgar."
She paused and sighed and looked to Drizzt helplessly.
"And more for me,"
the drow said with a mischievous grin.
"Much more."
Catti Bree glanced back over her shoulder, back to the west, where the sun was already beginning its descent.
"The days are short," she remarked. "And the road is long."
"Only as long as you make it,"
Drizzt said to her, drawing her gaze back to him.
"And the days are only as short as you allow them to be."
Catti Bree eyed him curiously, not understanding that last statement. Drizzt was grinning widely as he explained, as full of anticipation as was Catti Bree.
"A friend of mine, a blind old ranger, once told me that if you ride hard and fast enough to the west, the sun will never set for you."
By the time he had finished the statement, Catti Bree had wheeled her roan and was in full gallop across the frozen plain toward the west, toward Nesme and Longsaddle beyond that, toward mighty Waterdeep and the Sword Coast. She bent low in the saddle, her mount running hard, her cloak billowing and snapping in the wind behind her, her thick auburn hair flying wildly. Drizzt opened a belt pouch and looked at the onyx panther figurine. No one could ask for better companions, he mused. And with a final look to the mountains, to Mithril Hall, where his friend was king, the ranger kicked his stallion into a gallop and chased after Catti Bree. To the west, and the adventures of the wide world. This book is over, but the story continues. Keep listening after the credits to hear the beginning of Passage to Dawn, Book 4 in The Legend of Drizzt, Legacy of the Drow series, free. This has been an Audible Frontiers production of Siege of Darkness, written by R.A. Salvatore, narrated by Victor Bavine, producer Mike Charzik. Copyright 1994-2006 by TSR Inc., Wizards of the Coast Inc. Production copyright 2013 by Audible Inc. And now, a free preview of Passage to Dawn, Book 4 in The Legend of Drizzt, Legacy of the Drow series. Prologue. She was beautiful, shapely, and pale-skinned, with thick, lustrous hair cascading halfway down her naked back. Her charms were offered openly, brazenly, conveyed to him at the end of a gentle touch. So gentle. Little brushing fingers of energy tickled his chin, his jawbone, his neck. Every muscle of his body tensed, and he fought for control, battled the seductress with every bit of willpower remaining in him after so many years. He didn't even know why he resisted anymore, didn't consciously remember what offerings of the other world, the real world, might be fueling his stubbornness. What were right and wrong in this place? What might be the price of pleasure? What more did he have to give? The gentle touch continued, soothing his trembling muscles, raising goosebumps across his skin wherever those fingers brushed, calling to him, bidding him to surrender. Surrender. He felt his willpower draining away, argued against his stubbornness. There was no reason to resist. He could have soft sheets and a comfortable mattress, the smell, the awful reek, so terrible that even years had not allowed him to get used to it, could be taken away. She could do that with her magic. She had promised him. Falling fast, he half-closed his eyes and felt the touch continuing, felt it more keenly than before. He heard her snarl, a feral, bestial sound. Now he looked past her. They were on the lip of a ridge, one of countless ridges across the broken, heaving ground that trembled as if it were a living thing, breathing, laughing at him, mocking him. They were up high, he knew that. The ravine beyond the ridge was wide, and yet he could not see more than a couple of feet beyond the edge. The landscape was lost in the perpetual, swirling grayness, the smoky pall. The abyss. Now it was his turn to growl, a sound that was not feral, not primal, but one of rationale, of morality, of that tiny spark that remained in him of who he had been. He grabbed her hand and forced it away, turning it, twisting it. Her strength in resisting confirmed his memories, for it was supernatural, far beyond what her frame should have allowed. Still, he was the stronger, and he forced the hand away, turned it about, then set his stare upon her. Her thick hair had shifted a bit, and one of her tiny white horns had poked through.
"Do not, my lover,"
she purred. The weight of her plea nearly broke him. Like her physical strength, her voice carried more than was natural. Her voice was a conduit of charms, of deceit, of the ultimate lie that was all this place. A scream erupted from his lips, and he heaved her backward with all his strength, hurled her from the ridge. Huge bat-like wings unfolded behind her, and the succubus hovered, laughing at him, her open mouth revealing horrid fangs that would have punctured his neck. She laughed, and he knew that although he had resisted, he had not won, could never win. She had almost broken him this time, come closer to it than the last, and would be closer still the next. And so she laughed at him, mocked him, always mocking him. He realized that it had been a test, always a test. He knew who had arranged it, and was not surprised when the whip tore into his back, laying him low. He tried to take cover, felt the intense heat building all around him, but knew that there was no escape. A second snapping had him crawling for the ledge. Then came a third lash, and he grabbed onto the lip of the ridge, screamed, and pulled himself over, wanting to pitch into the ravine, to splatter his corporeal form against the rocks, desperate to die. Ertu, the great Balor, 12 feet of smoking, deep red scales and corded muscles, casually walked to the edge and peered over. With eyes that had seen through the mists of the abyss since the dawn of time, Ertu sought out the falling form, then reached out to him. He was falling slower. Then he was not falling at all. He was rising, caught in a telekinetic web reeled in by the master. The whip was waiting, and the next lash sent him spiraling, mercifully, into unconsciousness. Ertu did not retract the whip's cords. The Balor used the same telekinetic energy to wrap them about the victim, binding him fast. Ertu looked back to the hysterical succubus and nodded. She had done well this day. Drool slipped over her bottom lip at the sight of the unconscious form. She wanted to feast. In her eyes, the table was set and waiting. A flap of her wings brought her back to the ledge, and she approached cautiously, seeking some way through the Balor's defenses. Ertu let her get close, so close, then gave a slight tug on the whip. His victim flopped away weirdly, jumping past the Balor's perpetual flames. Ertu shifted a step to the side, putting his bulk between the victim and the succubus. "I must," she whined, daring to move a bit closer, half walking and half flying. Her deceivingly delicate hands reached out and grasped at the smoky air. She trembled and panted. Ertu stepped aside. She inched closer. The Balor was teasing her, she knew, but she could not turn away, not with the sight of this helpless one. She whined, knowing she was going to be punished, but she could not stop. Taking a slightly roundabout route, she walked past the Balor. She whined again, her feet digging a firm hold, that she might rush to the prone victim and taste of him at least once before Ertu denied her. Out shot Ertu's arm, holding a sword that was wrought of lightning. He lifted it high and uttered a command, and the ground jolted with the strength of a thunderstroke. The succubus waited and leaped away, running for the ledge and then flying off of it, shrieking all the while. Ertu's lightning hit her in the back and sent her spinning, and she was far below the edge of the ridge before she regained control. Back on the ledge, Ertu gave her not another thought. The Balor was thinking of his prisoner, always of his prisoner. He enjoyed tormenting the wretch, but had to continually sublimate his bestial urges. He could not destroy this one, could not break him too far, else the victim would hold no value for the Balor. This was but one being, and measured against the promise of the freedom to walk again on the prime material plane, that did not seem so much. Only Driz Doerden, the renegade dark elf, the one who had banished Ertu to 100 years in the abyss, could grant that freedom. The drow would do that, Ertu believed, in exchange for the wretch. Ertu turned his horned, ape-like head to look over one massive shoulder. The fires that surrounded the Balor burned low now, simmering, as was Ertu's rage. Patience, the Balor reminded himself. The wretch was valuable and had to be preserved. The time was coming, Ertu knew. He would speak with Driz Doerden before another year had passed on the material plane. Ertu had made contact with the witch, and she would deliver his message. Then the Balor, one of the true Tanari, among the greatest denizens of the lower planes, would be free. Then Ertu could destroy the wretch, could destroy Drizdo Erden, and could destroy every being that loved the renegade drow. Patience. Part 1. Wind and Spray. 6 years. Not so long in the lifespan of a drow. And yet, in counting the months, the 10 days, the days, the hours, it seemed to me as if I had been away from Mithril Hall 100 times that number. The place was removed. Another lifetime. Another way of life. A mere stepping stone to... to what? To where? My most vivid memory of Mithril Hall is of riding away from the place with Catti Bree at my side, is the view and looking back over the plumes of smoke rising from Settlestone to the mountain called Fourth Peak. Mithril Hall was Brunner's kingdom, Brunner's home, and Brunner was among the most dear of friends to me. But it was not my home, had never been so. I couldn't explain it then, and still cannot. All should have been well there after the defeat of the invading drow army. Mithril Hall shared prosperity and friendship with all of the neighboring communities, was part of an assortment of kingdoms with the power to protect their borders and feed their poor. All of that. But still Mithril Hall was not home. Not for me. And not for Catti Bree. Thus had we taken to the road, riding west to the coast, to Waterdeep. I never argued with Catti Bree, though she had certainly expected me to, concerning her decision to leave Mithril Hall. We were of like minds. We had never really set down our hearts in the place. We had been too busy in defeating the enemies who ruled there, in reopening the dwarven mines, in traveling to Menzo Baranzon, and in battling the dark elves who had come to Mithril Hall. All that completed, it seemed time to settle, to rest, to tell and to lengthen tales of our adventures. If Mithril Hall had been our home before the battles, we would have remained. After the battles, after the losses, for both Catti Bree and Drizdo Erden, it was too late. Mithril Hall was Brunner's place, not ours. It was the war-scarred place where I had to again face the legacy of my dark heritage. It was the beginning of the road that had led me back to Menzo Baranzon. It was the place where Wulfgar had died. Catti Bree and I vowed that we would return there one day, and so we would, for Brunner was there and Regis. But Catti Bree had seen the truth. You can never get the smell of blood out of the stones. If you were there when that blood was spilled, the continuing aroma evokes images too painful to live beside. 6 years. And I have missed Brunner and Regis, Stumpet Rakingclaw, and even Berkthgar the Bold, who rules Settlestone. I have missed my journeys to wondrous Silvery Moon, and watching the dawn from one of Fourth Peak's many rocky perches. I ride the waves along the Sword Coast now, the wind and spray in my face. My ceiling is the rush of clouds and the canopy of stars. My floor is the creaking boards of a swift, well-weathered ship. And beyond that, the azure blanket, flat and still, heaving and rolling, hissing in the rain and exploding under the fall of a breaching whale. Is this my home? I know not. Another stepping stone, I would guess. But whether there really is a road that would lead me to a place called home, I do not know. Nor do I think about it often, because I've come to realize that I do not care. If this road, this series of stepping stones, leads nowhere, then so be it. I walk the road with friends, and so I have my home. Drizdt Do'Urden.
Chapter 1 The Sea Sprite. Drizzt Do'Urden stood on the very edge of the beam, as far forward as he could go, one hand grasping tight the guide rope of the flying jib. This ship was a smooth runner, perfect in balance and ballast, and with the best of crews. But the sea was rough this day, and the Sea Sprite cut and bounced through the rolls at full sail, throwing a heavy spray. Drizzt didn't mind. He loved the feel of the spray and the wind, the smell of the brine. This was freedom, flying, skimming the water, skipping the waves. Drizzt's thick white hair flipped in the breeze, billowing like his green cape behind him, drying almost as fast as the water soaked it. Splotches of white-caked salt could not lessen the luster of his ebony skin, which glistened with wetness. His violet eyes sparkled with joy as he squinted at the horizon and caught a fleeting glimpse of the sails of the ship they pursued. Pursued and would catch, Drizzt knew, for there was no ship north of Baldur's Gate that could outrun Captain Dudermont's Sea Sprite. She was a three-masted schooner, new in design, light, sleek, and full of sail. The square-rigged caravel they were chasing could put up a fair run in a straight line, but any time the bulkier vessel altered its course even the slightest bit, the Sea Sprite could angle inside it, gaining ground, always gaining ground. That was what she was meant to do. Built by the finest engineers and wizards of Waterdeep, funded by the lords of that city, the schooner was a pirate chaser. How thrilled Drizzt had been to discover the good fortunes of his old friend Dudermont, with whom he had sailed all the way from Waterdeep to Calimshan in pursuit of Artemis and Treri when the assassin had captured Regis the Halfling. That journey, particularly the fight in Asavir's Channel when Captain Dudermont had won, with no small help from Drizzt and his companions, against three pirate ships, including the flagship of the notorious Pinochet, had caught the attention of sailors and merchants all along the Sword Coast. When the lords of Waterdeep had completed this schooner, they had offered it to Dudermont. He loved his little two-master, the original Sea Sprite, but no seaman could resist this new beauty. Dudermont had accepted a commission in their service, and they had granted him the right to name the vessel and allowed him to hand-pick his crew. Drizzt and Catti Bree had arrived in Waterdeep some time after that. When the Sea Sprite next put into the grand harbor of the seaport, and Dudermont found his old friends, he promptly made room for them among his crew of 40. That was 6 years and 27 voyages ago. Among those who monitored the shipping lanes of the Sword Coast, particularly among the pirates themselves, the schooner had become a scourge. 37 victories, and still she sailed. Now number 38 was in sight. The caravel had noticed them, from too far away to see the flag of Waterdeep. That hardly mattered, for no other ship in the region carried the distinctive design of a Sea Sprite, the three masts of billowing triangular lateen sails. Up came the caravel's square rigs, and so the chase was on in full. Drizzt was at the point, one foot on the lion-headed ram, loving every second. He felt the sheer power of the sea bucking beneath him, felt the spray and the wind. He heard the music, loud and strong, for several of the Sea Sprite's crewmen were minstrels, and whenever the chase was on, they took up their instruments and played rousing songs. 2,000! Catti Bree yelled down from the crow's nest. It was a measure of the distance yet to gain. When her estimate got down to 500, the crew would move to their battle posts, three going to the large ballista mounted on a pivot atop the flying deck on the Sea Sprite's stern, two going to the smaller, swiveling crossbows mounted to the forward corners of the bridge. Drizzt would join Dudermont at the helm, coordinating the close combat. The drow's free hand slipped to the hilt of one of his scimitars at the thought. The Sea Sprite was a vicious foe from a distance. It had crack archers, a skilled ballista team, a particularly nasty wizard, an evoker full of fireballs and lightning bolts, and of course, Catti Bree with her deadly bow, Talmaril the Heartseeker. But it was in close when Drizzt and his panther companion Guinevar and the other skilled warriors could get across, that the Sea Sprite was truly deadly. 1,800, came Catti Bree's next call. Drizzt nodded at the confirmation of their speed, though the gain was truly startling.
The Sea Sprite was running faster than ever. Drizzt had to wonder if her keel was even getting wet. The drow dropped a hand into his pouch, feeling for the magical figurine that he used to summon the panther from the astral plane, wondering if he should even call to Guinevar this time. The panther had been aboard for much of the last 10 days, hunting the hundreds of rats that threatened the ship's food stores, and was likely exhausted.
"Only if I need you, my friend," Drizzt whispered. The Sea Sprite cut hard to starboard, and Drizzt had to take up the guide rope in both hands.
He steadied himself and remained silent, his gaze to the horizon, to the square-rigged ship growing larger by the minute. Drizzt felt deep within himself, mentally preparing for the coming battle. He immersed himself in the hiss and splash of the water below him, in the rousing music cutting the wind, and in Catty Bree's calls. 1,500, 1,000. "Black cutlass, lined in red!" the young woman shouted down when, thanks to her spyglass, she was able to discern the design on the snapping flag of the caravel. Drizzt didn't know the insignia, but didn't care about it. The caravel was a pirate ship, one of the many who had overstepped their bounds near Waterdeep's harbors. As in any waters with trading routes, there had always been pirates on the Sword Coast. Until the last few years, though, the pirates had been somewhat civil, following specific codes of conduct. When Dudemont had defeated Pinochet in Asavir's Channel, he had subsequently let the pirate go free. That was the way, the unspoken agreement. No longer was that the case. The pirates of the north had become bolder and more vicious. Ships were no longer simply looted, but the crews, particularly if any females were aboard, were tortured and murdered. Many ruined hulks had been found adrift in the waters near Waterdeep. The pirates had crossed the line. Drizzt, Dudermont, and all the Sea Sprite's crew were being paid handsomely for their work, but down to every last man and woman, with the possible exception of the wizard, Robillard, they weren't chasing pirates for the gold. They were fighting for the victims.
500! Catty Bree called down.
Drizzt shook himself from his trance and looked to the caravel. He could see the men on her decks now, scrambling, preparing for the fight, an army of ants. The Sea Sprite's crew was outnumbered, possibly 2-1, Drizzt realized, and the caravel was heavily armed. She carried a fair-sized catapult on her stern deck, and probably a ballista beneath that, ready to shoot out from the open windows. The drow nodded and turned back to the deck. The crossbows fixed on the bridge and the ballista was manned. Many of the crew lined the rail, testing the pull of their longbows. The minstrels played on as they would right up until the boarding began. High above the deck, Drizzt spotted Catty Bree, Tall Marill in one hand, her spyglass in the other. He whistled to her, and she gave a quick wave in response, her excitement obvious. How could it be otherwise? The chase, the wind, the music, and the knowledge that they were doing good work here. Smiling widely, the drow skittered back along the beam, and then the rail, joining Dudermont at the wheel. He noticed Robillard the wizard, looking bored as usual, sitting on the edge of the poop deck. Every so often he waved one hand in the direction of the mainmast. Robillard wore a huge ring on that hand, a silver band set with a diamond, and its sparkle now came from more than a reflection of the light. With every gesture from the wizard, the ring loosed its magic, sending a strong gust of wind into the already straining sails. Drizzt heard the creak of protest from the mainmast and understood their uncanny speed.
"Caracas!" Captain Dudermont remarked as soon as the drow was beside him. "Black cutlass outlined in red."
Drizzt looked at him curiously, not knowing the name.
"Used to sail with Pinochet," Dudermont explained. "First mate on the pirate's flagship. He was among those we battled in Asavir's Channel."
"Captured?" Drizzt asked. Dudermont shook his head.
"Caracas is a scrag, a sea troll."
"I do not remember him."
"He has a penchant for staying out of the way," Dudermont replied. "Likely he dived overboard, taking to the depths as soon as Wolfgar turned us about to ram his ship."
Drizzt remembered the incident, the incredible pull of his strong friend that nearly turned the original Sea Sprite on its stern, right into the faces of so many surprised pirates.
"Caracas was there, though," Dudermont continued. "By all reports, it was he who rescued Pinochet's wounded ship when I set him adrift outside of Memnon."
And is the Scrag allied with Pinochet still? Drizzt asked. Dudermont nodded grimly. The implications were obvious. Pinochet couldn't come after the troublesome sea sprite personally, because in return for his freedom he had sworn off vengeance against Dudermont. The pirate had other ways of repaying enemies. He had many allies, like Caracas, who were not bound by his personal oath. Drizzt knew at that moment that Guinevere would be needed, and he took the intricate figurine from his pouch. He studied Dudermont carefully. The man stood tall and straight, slender.